Let's officially start. We're not talking about school closings and school openings here in this panel. We're talking about something that I think is going to interest a lot of people. Talking about diversification. And what we are trying to do, what we will be trying to do in this panel, and I'll introduce our panelists in a second, we're gonna try to show that there is many different ways of diversifying your services. And we're gonna look at whether it's a beneficial thing to do that or a necessary thing, or whether it's not, whether it's something that that essentially is up to you. We will also try to show that talking about diversity, so let me back up a little bit. When I first started to think about diversification for this panel, I did think of that in association with the ongoing crisis. But I think what we will try to do in this, during this hour and a half, is to show that we are not talking about diversification only in response to a crisis, but as something that should and could be part of a regular business routine. And what we also will try to show, and I think that's very important, is that we're not talking about diversification because translation and interpreting is not good enough. It's sort of a, you know, something that has to be bolstered by something, but is something that is just fine in itself, but might in fact benefit from you looking to diversify yourself. So that's what we're going to try to do. And I think it's going to be a very interesting hour and a half. And I'm pleased that there was a lot of interest in the registration. And I don't know how many people are listening to this right now, but I think you'll all benefit from it. Let me very briefly introduce our panelists. I will not go into great detail. I think you'll learn quite a bit about them in the course of our discussion. First of all, we have Karen. Karen lives in Denver, close to Denver, and she is a French to English translator, and she particularly specializes in chemistry. She actually has a PhD in chemistry from Cambridge. Then we have Gio. Gio lives in Miami. She is a translator from English into Portuguese. She's also the president of Abratis, the Brazilian Association for Translators and Interpreters. And she also will have to say quite a bit about diversification from a point of view that is a little different, I think, but very interesting. And lastly, last but not least, we have Mila. Mila is the owner and president of Masterboard, but she also started out as a translator and interpreter. But for the last 20 or so years, she has owned a company. And I'm very glad that we were able, because of her, to not only look at diversification for individual translators and interpreters, but from an LSP perspective as well. That's who we all are. And I wonder whether we can just, what we are trying to do is we're trying to make this as sort of natural and casual as possible. So while I'm sort of the moderator, I very much welcome for Karen, Gio, and Mila to ask questions also or interrupt each other. So we're trying to have a real conversation, and we think that not only you, but we also will learn quite a bit in the process. So how about if we first go around and talk about what diversification means to you, or what kind of diversification you have encountered in the course of your career. And diversification clearly is not only a diversification in the kinds of services, but in our case, of course, also means diversification in the industries you're serving, right? So there is a number of different kind of diversifications. Mila, do you want to go first? We're the last in the intro round, so do you want to?
Sure, I can start. So I had to diversify my entire life and change and adapt my entire life. So my first diversification was from being an interpreter into actually starting a company, which in a way was an accident by itself. It was just a larger client that needed more services, and I kind of naturally fell into it. And we started by focusing on just one industry, we were very heavily focused on oil and gas. Mm-hmm. And we unfortunately experienced quite a few rude awakenings every time there is a collapse with the oil and gas industry, which I think it's about every 5 or 7 years, where the industry can almost shuts down. So we had to scramble and figure out what else we're going to do. So we diversified into healthcare. And then after that, we had to diversify into education. And then the most recent turn of events is where education is not going on, you know, healthcare, only emergency rooms are kind of functioning and operational, but we have the hospitals themselves in great financial trouble. And oil and gas industry, we just also the negative oil price, right? The supply stopped. So we're having to diversify again, and we're diversifying in the lines of services that we're providing. So we had to launch what we call virtual interpreting because video remote interpreting was suddenly not working. The traditional VRI platform normally services where you have a patient and a doctor in the same room, but suddenly you did not have always a patient and a doctor in the same room. You had to have family members who would normally come into the hospital, and now they couldn't come into the hospital. And so suddenly there was a massive need to figure out how to incorporate all this other technology. And we also diversified and started working in something kind of brand new for us in terms of AI, in the field of AI and working with artificial intelligence, which was brand new diversification. So it's, I think the latest turn of events was the most challenging from that perspective, but it's, but we also had to do it all along the line.
So, you know, I know you longer than we both care to admit probably, Mila, so what I know that, you know, I've known you since the early oil and gas days where you essentially only served the oil and gas industry. We're in Houston, so it makes a lot of sense. You know, your office, in fact, is just a stone throw away from all kinds of headquarters of big oil and gas companies. But what, how easy was it for you, and what did it mean for you to say, you know, we see that there's an ever occurring downturn in the oil and gas industry. We can't just, you know, bank on this one industry. What did it mean for you to diversify into other industries? What kind of effort did you have to spend to do that?
It is incredibly hard. It's incredibly hard. It's kind of like you have to start all over again each time. First of all, when your business comes to a sudden stop, which originally oil was at that time $11 a barrel and everybody stopped doing business. We faced going from 30 people in the company on the project management side to 3 people pretty much overnight. And then it was, so you have to figure out a completely new industry. You know, the sales cycle is a pretty long sales cycle. So how do you sell into a new industry? How do you learn what the new industry needs? And how do you learn that quickly? So it's a combination of luck. It's a combination of working incredibly hard. I remember at that time, the first time when I was going, okay, your average return of call is 1 out of 100. You know, you're now on call number 99 and the person says, I don't need your services, I'm not interested. You know, how do you pick yourself up? And then trying to figure out also the entire operational chain on how you service that. And I'm referring back to, you know, going back to 3 people, going back to relearn everything and working that, you know, 100-hour week all the time. And so in a way, the same thing is happening right now. It's a little bit easier because we're much bigger in size, but it's still nevertheless not any easier in terms of workload or in terms of learning new things or in terms of suddenly under pressure having to think completely out of the box.
Mm-hmm. So for an LSP, it's not necessarily a painless process, right? It's something that you have to you know, take the losses along the way to do this, or have, take a lot of pain on the way to be able to do that.
And you have a lot of responsibility for everybody who's working on the team. One That's of right. our key focuses is how do we keep the team? How do we realign the team? What do we do different? So it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of thought process. And but also the positive is great ideas normally come under pressure. So, you know, we were able to launch the virtual interpreting solution literally within 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then how do you get the clients to switch to that? So it's a little bit too much excitement on the way. It's not an easy process, but it's kind of like going down the up and down the roller coaster without the seatbelt attached, right? Trying not to fall out of the cart.
Karen, what about you? Do you what has diversification meant for you and your business?
Yeah. So when I started as a freelance translator, that's all I intended to be, a freelance translator. That was my intention. And I started to diversify because work came to me. I was offered work and I tried it. So those two kinds of work that I wasn't expecting were localization for English, which is just always been a minor part. Just I localize English for all sorts of people. But the bigger, more important diversification is editing of texts written by authors, usually academics who are scientists writing in English when that's not their native language. Yeah. So that non-native editing work came my way initially. People saw that I was an into English translator who knew a lot about chemistry, and they know I understand the subject. And I liked both of those. The localization is just a little thing that's a change as good as the rest kind of a topic, but the non-native editing, I enjoyed it, really enjoyed it. And it gives me more exposure to the subject matter expertise that I want to grow and learn in for my translation work. So it's a win-win. I mean, it's great. I'm improving my written English. I'm thinking about English in isolation when I do that work. And it's giving me subject matter expertise that I can take back to my translation work. So that's one I've been doing a long time, and I never marketed it for myself, but I get word of mouth, lots and lots of word of mouth from all these scientists who say, oh, so-and-so did mine. You need tech, that lady in Colorado, she edited my paper and it wasn't rejected, but you know, for poor English.
So have you now started to market it after you've seen that this is something that benefits you and fits very well?
So last year I did a complete website redesign and I included it in that. So for the first time, so I started translating 2005. So it was 14 years till last year before I ever actively had anything on my website that was sort of talking about it. And in the last few years, I've been training. I've given conference sessions at, you know, American Translators Association conferences or Institute of Translation and Interpreting conferences and the like. So other freelancers know that I do this. And so some referrals come to me that way too. Yeah. So it's not like I market myself actively in contacting academics. It's that it's now out there that I do this. So that kind of sort of that way of marketing it. Yeah, and there are other things that I've done once in a while, but they never came back to me. Like I've edited pharma procedures before they were going to be localized. You know, someone sends me big pharma docs and I edit them before they go into 23 other languages. I love that kind of work, which isn't, you might not call that diversification, but it's the kind of thing that comes my way from time to time because of my subject matter expertise.
So. That's great. So I think what's particularly interesting about your case are two things. One, that you know, we often talk about the fact that a good translator needs to have good writing skills. I mean, that's a, you know, very natural part of being a good translator, and you know, you're sort of a proof of that. I mean, you know, it is because of your writing skills that you are doing those, offering those other services and improving your translation in the process, right? I mean, improving your translation process. Right. And it's also interesting, and I think a little bit different than to some of us, that essentially fell into your lap. And now that it's fallen into your lap, you kind of are trying to do maybe more.
Right, so exactly. So I was very, I mean, sometimes like Mila said, sometimes things just happen accidentally. They weren't part of your plan. Sometimes they're strategic and all that, but this was one of those things that just came my way, like exactly like you said.
So Gio, what about you? What does diversification mean to you, and what has diversification meant for you in your work history or your work life?
Diversification actually started before I became a translator and interpreter. It came to me as an accident, just fell on my lap. I wasn't thinking about it, meaning my work was going in a completely different direction. We got laid off from the bank we used to work for, and somebody said, come help me with this translation. I didn't even know it was a profession, had not dawned on me yet. And that's how I started. I used to teach English also, and the two things combined. And the job I had before, I was also an interpreter. I used to do everything. I was an interpreter and a translator at the job. I just didn't know those were professions, you know. They were just means of putting food on the table. Cool. And then when I finally embodied that responsibility professionally, I also realized that translating only or interpreting only would not allow me to live the standard of living I was used to. I also had my children to take care of. So I started to look at different aspects of it. Thankfully, my professional experience allowed me to taste different things. I worked with the ATA as in their marketing department. It was all a volunteer thing. I don't know if you remember, Karen, but in the 90s, when we had many colleagues involved in it and we all participated and generated ideas and discussed approaches. So that became part of what I do now too. I'm very involved in that area in my job. I design websites for colleagues. I help them develop their own and things of that nature. I'm actually going to be teaching a course in marketing coming September, you know. Besides that, in my interpreting, also because of the work with the ATA, I became more of an activist. I became more involved with causes that people were kind of dismissing. And I started to work with the International Medical Interpreters Association in their division called the National Board of Certification for Medical Interpreters, NCBMI. So I started working with them, and BCMI, sorry, started working with them as a director, became their vice chair, and the administrative part of the job and the mentoring part of the job became very ingrained on me. And now working with Abraches, I'm bringing it all together. I mean, here in the U.S., I founded with other colleagues the Florida chapter of the ATA, because we lost the first one after my term. Two terms after mine, they closed the chapter, so we had to reopen it. So all these experiences informed me that I had other talents that could be still associated with translation, interpreting, communication, but involved other talents. They were not related. And I started to look for courses and deepen that knowledge. And this is something I teach to everybody I mentor nowadays, is don't focus only on what you're doing, but also on what you're going to be doing in the future. Look into that. Strengthen other skills. So diversification, for me, is multifaceted. I look at myself as a mosaic. You know, each one little bit that I have acquired during my experience have created the person I am And I am really looking forward to the next little pieces to come to see who I'm going to be maybe 5 years from now.
Well, we're looking forward to that too. Thank you. And before we go to the next question or next part of our panel, I would like to say two things. One thing is that most of you, and I'm talking to the audience now, know or should know that this is interpreted also into a number of languages. And from the feedback in the messaging app, I see that the interpreting is really outstanding. So if you would like to listen to this in Chinese, friends or family, then please do so by selecting. You see on the left-hand bottom, you see the floor selector. And if you click on that, you'll see the different languages that you can choose from as well. Also, I would like to say that that Multilingual is trying to use a different model with these summer conversations. And the model is that they have sponsors. This is sponsored by MemSource. And we, of course, are very grateful that MemSource is sponsoring this conversation. So having said that, let's talk about 2020. 2020 is obviously, you know, I mean, I don't know how many adjectives have been used to describe 2020. Typically, they're not positive adjectives. I mean, it's been a really, really difficult year, personally, for all of us, every single one of us, every single one of our listeners, and has also been a difficult year business-wise. Now, I do think that translation and interpreting, well, I should only talk about translation in this context because that's where I personally know more. I know translation has been affected quite badly in the very first few weeks, but then has gradually recovered now. I think translation is doing quite well, actually, right now again. Interpreting has radically changed. I think we can say that for sure. Remote interpreting has become kind of the go-to way of offering interpreting services, which has been difficult for many, many interpreters, but, you know, has really pushed them to accept new technology much faster than, I think, for instance, translators had to accept technology. Translators, we started to use technology a little bit earlier than interpreters, and we had a really hard time doing that. Interpreters now have been, well, for interpreters, essentially, it has been a matter of continuing interpreting by using remote technology or not continuing interpreting. But let's talk about what 2020 has so far meant for you in relation to diversification. Mila, because 2020 isn't over, but we all have a really strong impression, I think, already what 2020 has done for us business-wise, and in particular in relation to diversification. I know that you've started to diversify much earlier than 2020. You've been doing that for 10, 15 years now, but has 2020 pushed you more into diversifying your services?
Absolutely. It is kind of learning to swim when you're in the middle of the water and, you know, you never swam before. You either swim or you drown, right? So we're at this point, we're a much larger company, right? We have almost 100 full-time team, and then of course a large part-time team. So it meant reinventing technology. It meant completely changing the way we look at our business, because interpreting literally changed overnight. And hopefully one day in-person interpreting will return again. But at this point, the form of language access completely changed overnight. So we had to look not just at the traditional forms of remote interpreting, which is OPI and VRI, but again, at all the other platforms, all of the other solutions. And then translation-wise, we had to look at, first of all, there was an incredible increase in rush requests as everybody was trying to get out emergency communications. So how do we change the operation model? How do we improve the workflows? And then also looking more at what other industries we can partner up with. And doing all of that pretty much overnight was the biggest challenge of this year. But I also want to reflect on another part that Gio mentioned, personal diversification. And while being also very involved with the traditional areas, advocacy for the language professional and staying with advocacy for the linguists, we also got diversified and got involved in bringing in the concept or even the idea of language access to fields like human trafficking and fields of social importance, and trying to, we've been very actively involved with working with different organizations, trying to raise awareness, especially right now, the times of crisis. How do you communicate about COVID with the communities that don't know how to communicate? And we had a very interesting project with Translation Commons where we launched a poster and trying to reach 6,000 languages with one poster very quickly. And how do you put 6,000 languages on a poster, right? There's only 4,000 written languages and 3,000 not spoken. And how do you create a poster where people didn't see running water? And how do you distribute that poster? And so it was an amazing collaborative project with Translation Commons that ended up being done and then used actually on a global level to communicate. We had to integrate voice technology, we had to integrate written technology, we had to think completely outside the box, get communities to contribute that weren't even part of, they're not even part of your regular translation localization, the world. And so that was another very interesting and exciting diversification that happened this year. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I think it's so interesting that you mentioned human rights in, you know, in the larger context, because to be really honest, when the crisis first struck and everybody was kind of scrambling to see how we can deal with business that changed overnight, human rights was not on my radar at first. Only when I think on Twitter asked, where people find a lot of work these days, human rights was one of the answers. I mean, human rights, in fact, was suggested by several people. So human rights.
They're slammed. Those translators are slammed.
Exactly, which I think is really interesting. And it's not something that, maybe it's just me because I'm very thick, but it was not something that came to me, just like that. It was brought up by people who are working in this area and suddenly didn't know how to handle as many jobs and that as were available. But it's also interesting, Mila, that so you talked about the switch to remote interpreting, but of course that's something you've been doing for quite a while. I mean, remote interpreting is not something that you started in 2020, but instead it's something that you've started a number of years ago, haven't you?
But of course, we started many years ago. But what happened was, in the past, it was kind of looked down upon because everybody prefers in-person communication, right? You have 80% of communication is nonverbal. So everybody prefers to have that human touch. And there was a lot of debate, is VRI acceptable? Is VRI something that should be offered to patients? Is OPI really good, or is it a secondary quality language access? But overnight, that was the only option. Mm-hmm. And so anybody who was not set up for that option didn't have effective language access. And also look at it from the interpreter point of view. If you're going, and we worked and helped during the Ebola crisis, we actually worked kind of, we were providing interpreting services to Ebola patients. So as an interpreter going into that type of setting, you are risking your life and the amount of stress that the interpreter is experiencing. So what happened with this COVID crisis is the acceptance rate of new technology literally happened overnight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting, really interesting. I mean, of course, we're all aware of that, but it's just interesting to realize that once again, how much our that part of our industry has changed overnight, and it'll be super interesting. Go ahead.
Right, and there is another aspect of it, and Mila is gonna agree with me, because with translation, the main problem is how do you send it out? How do you get to other people's hands? Fine, But with languages, the spoken or sign aspect of it, you have to look in terms of those languages of lesser diffusion, just like she mentioned, the languages that have no written language, they're only spoken. For example, how do you handle that? Or even the spoken languages that do not have a certain level of schooling or a certain level of alphabetization, literacy, how you handle that. These are all aspects that you have to deal with. And as far as remote interpreting, OPI got such a bad rap when it started. Remember, Mila? That was so difficult. Fine, you're in Miami, you're not gonna have that hard time find somebody to interpret for Spanish, but for Hmong, for Tigrinya, for a number of other languages, that's gonna be impossible. What are you gonna do? In the hospital, tell the bacteria or the virus, please stop working, why do I get an interpreter for us? You can't do that. Or in court, how long is that a defendant gonna be in jail waiting for an interpreter to be found? So these were solutions that became more than needed. They became a staple in our industry because it became necessary.
Yeah.
Circumstances.
So Gio, for you, has if you look back on 2020 with your business and maybe personally, but have you done more in human rights translation, or what kind of changes has that meant for you, Gio?
I'm not a very good example in that area right now because I actually don't have a lot of work at this time. I'm not working a lot, and part of it is by choice because I have a lot of issues in my personal life that I'm having to deal with.
Yeah.
And so I'm not doing a lot of client procurement, and the clients I used to work with, they are not in the area of, I was focusing on interpreting and doing a lot of conference interpreting, and that has really gone down. Many of the companies are still finding out how they can come back to having meetings, you know, so that is stopped. But I'm kind of lucky. I lost my voice April last year, and I had to go back to translation, almost full-time translation. So I got my translator's portfolio building up again, and I'm depending on it and doing quite well for where I am right now. And as far as interpreting is concerned, I would have gone to at least 8 trips right now. And I have not done, I think I did 3 interpreting assignments in the whole of the year. 3 interpreting assignments, that's it.
Yep. Of course, you know, when it comes to how conferences can be interpreted, our platform Kudu goes like, we have an idea how conferences can be interpreted.
But don't talk to me about that, okay? Because 2016, we're 2020, right? 2016, I had my conference, my online conference. I discovered at the time was HeadVox. I think they are defunct by now. I'm not sure. If I'm wrong, somebody correct me. And Kudu. So I spoke with both of them. I had both of them on my event. It was wonderful. We had people from 18 different countries. The only 2 continents that were not represented were Africa and Antarctica. And then I went to the companies that do online events and I asked them, would you like to put a language element into your offerings? And nobody's asking for that. I explained to them why, you know, WebRTC, the RSI platforms. And I went to RSI platform companies and I spoke to them, why don't you work with these companies? Get the 2 of you together. It's going to be a killer. And nobody listened to me.
Now it is a killer. Because now we have.
Now. And they are 4 years late.
So, Karen,
oh, well,
what was 2020 like for you?
Yeah, so Yeah, I'm one of those translators where there's the big dip, but I wanted to disagree slightly with what you said. You said you thought that translators had had a dip and then it was all picking up. And I didn't see that actually. I saw three groups of translators. There's the ones who were slammed. Human rights was a great example. Also, people working for school districts, like communications to parents regarding anything and everything, because we've had, like, you know, 20 times more communication from school districts than we do in a normal year this year, speaking personally anyway. So there were groups of translators who were just slammed. Corporate communications also, you know, all that. Yeah. Corporate communication that we all received. So there were a number of translators who've just been very, very busy all year. I know some who've told me no change, nothing. Couldn't tell you a single thing different. I can think of a financial translator, for instance, who said to me in the summer, it's been a completely normal year for me. So some people are not being affected for whatever reason. Yeah. I was affected. I'm down about 40% year on year. Only since the end of July, just 2-3 weeks ago, have I had what I would call solid volume of translation work. What I have had comfortably all year is that non-native editing work that I mentioned, that diversified. So usually that makes up 20%, about 15 to 20 to 23% of my gross annual revenue. And this year it's at about 30. So it held steady. So it's, you know, percentage has gone up and my translation dropped and was just slow. And I work for both LSPs and end clients. And as you alluded to before, Jost, almost everyone, everything I do is related to chemistry. So pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, paint, adhesive, you name it. If it's chemical, I do it. But it was, you know, it's not an industry that was suffering during 2020. It's not, you know, obviously some of that industry has been thriving in 2020, manufacturing hand sanitizer and all the other things that we all want so much of. But I just found that the month when everyone transferred to working from home was dead. And then it just, some clients started to come back little by little. So for me, that non-native editing has been important to me during this year. And the other thing that happened in 2020, if you like, is that during a quiet week earlier in the summer, I came across an NMT editing project specifically in pharma. And I applied and, unexpectedly for me, they accepted my hourly rate. So I am working on an NMT editing project, which I would probably not, I wouldn't have looked at under normal circumstances, could have, because I'd have been too busy and I would have assumed they wouldn't pay my rate. And, you know, so I'm trying something new and it may just be an experiment or it may turn into something I continue doing. But it's another interesting way of using my subject matter expertise. You know, and it's a different skill set than translating this edit. And it's not something I've ever done except for consulting to give someone feedback on how good or bad their results were.
Aptitude coming together.
And we have discovered, you know, for us, it was training AI. This would have been a project I would have passed completely. But another way we diversified and also changed during this kind of dead times or when everything went quiet. And again, we did have a lot of peaks, you know, with, you know, corporate communications. And in some areas, it's been growing like crazy and other areas completely shut down. So what we did is we also turned to training and we looked at how we can support our industry. And we actually launched a whole bunch of training for interpreters and for translators dealing with COVID, dealing with stress, working with infectious diseases. And so we were, what does it mean trauma-informed interpreting? How can you survive, support victims of human trafficking? You know, the instances of child sexual abuse online went up 400% during this time. So how can we help those communities? So we actually ended up doing a lot of volunteer work in a way, or work that wasn't getting paid for. But at the same time, that kept our team very, very organized, very occupied at the time when instead of worrying about what's going to happen, we turned that into what can we do for the community and how we can support that. So it was another way of diversifying that probably normally wouldn't have happened if everything didn't come to a stop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. That's good. I'm thankful to you, Karen, that you mentioned that you disagreed with me, because I think I just did what I think we all tend to do sometimes, that we overgeneralize by looking at our own situation, right? And the reason why I'm glad that we bring this up is because I think one of the things that we should be excited and proud about is how diverse our industries are. They're so vastly diverse, right? And I think that anything you say with great certainty about our industry is given to be wrong.
Absolutely. Right? Completely agree with that one, Joost. You're right. We can't generalize. So, my experience of yours and Geo's and completely different. Yeah.
And think in terms of geographic markets, for example, a colleague of mine in Brazil who used to do 100,000 words a month went down to 70. I mean, in terms of words, man, that's nothing. But think in terms of the money he's losing. 30,000 words is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, so 30% drop. Well, I'm at a 40% drop in revenue, you know, year on year. And I make a good income. I mean, I do well as freelancers go, apparently, give it, you know, given the numbers I look at, if I'm going to generalize. it's a lot of people are hurting, even in translation, let alone in interpreting, which of course is a, and LSPs, I bet you're all down. I mean, 10%, 20%, who knows what everyone's down.
Everybody is down on different numbers, and I guess everybody's trying to reinvent themselves. But one of the points I want to bring up, because you said how diverse our industry is. One of the things I've observed is we kind of exist in those bubbles. There is a bubble of localization. There is a bubble around interpreting. There is a bubble around almost by industry vertical, there are bubbles. And I think prior to COVID, we all existed more or less in those bubbles. And what's happening now, which I'm observing in a very interesting way, is people are starting to connect. People are starting to go look at, start working to working in different industries. And also interpreters are talking to translators. Localization is talking to, you know, other industries. And in a way, what I'm observing, at least from my map of the world, is we're being brought closer together as a profession, as a team. So hopefully it'll be interesting to see how that evolves.
That's, you know, that will be really interesting because, of course, we have not had those regular meetings, you know, industry events, conferences, etc., that we're also used to and you know, go to 3-4 times a year, or however much. And you would think that those events would bring us together. But I think you might be quite right, Mila, that that there's a different kind of coming together right now, even though it's remote. But because we are, you know, trying to deal with, we're trying to break those bubbles that you are, that you mentioned. I wonder whether we can talk about something that might be, I think that might, well, you might have different opinions. And that is whether it's sort of has to be in the DNA of translation and interpreting providers to diversify, whether diversification is a necessary part of business for language providers. And I think we can talk about that in a number of ways. One is we talked about the fact that, you know, so that you can't just be in a situation like in 2020, it's really dangerous to just be in one vertical, right? So you have to, in that case, we often had to offer services, not just in the, say, oil and gas, you know, for lack of better example now, but also in medical, also in legal, also in you know, other areas. And, whether diversification as far as doing other activities than the core activity of translation and interpreting is a necessary part of being a successful provider, whether LSP or individual provider. Does anyone have anything to say about that?
In my sure. mind, okay. yeah.
Go ahead.
In my mind, a freelancer has to look at him or herself as an entrepreneur. And that means being open to different opportunities, knowing one's limit, definitely. But there's so much being thrown in front of you. For example, now in Brazil, I'm going back to Brazil because I do a lot of mentoring down there and I see changes. Okay. One of my mentees was working in culinology, pharma, and corporate texts. That was her background. After our sessions, after designing a website and all of that, she's now working with, she went to learn audiovisual translation, subtitling, discovered narration, and I forgot the name, but it's a descriptive for movies for people who are visually impaired. And that's what she's doing. And she's teaching all over. She's now become an instructor in that specific area. So I mentioned to her, this is where you're starting. Solidify that knowledge you have, but don't forget to look at what else is available to you. You might find a different passion because this is what you're used to, but it may not be your actual calling. So take a look. She did. And I'm going to be taking classes with her next month. So yeah, you are a freelancer, you are an entrepreneur.
Yeah, see, I don't look at it that way. I mean, I see where you're coming from, but I think the answer is no, inherently, that as a, I'm not talking about LSPs here, but as an individual, because I'll let Mila speak for that, but as an individual translator or interpreter, some of the best are perfectly happy just translating or interpreting, and that's all they want to do. So my caveat for them would say, I think that in order to survive or to thrive, even, let's talk about thriving, we're beyond surviving. To thrive, you have to be getting feedback. So I would say you have to be working with other translators or interpreters and getting feedback to be, but that could be 100% of a great career for a very long time. Some translators won't even edit, for goodness sake, because that means, because they just translate. It won't even take on editing work. So I don't think it's inherently part of the job description. But I've given you an example of where, when things came to me, I tried them. That's my, so my personal experience is that I try things, but there are things I've tried and rejected too. So the perfect, the obvious example that always jumps out to me is project management. I don't like it, don't want to. So I have some direct clients and sometimes they say, would you, as well as English, will you give me this in, you know, French, German, and Arabic? And I groan and I, you know, well, not French, German, and Arabic because the source is French, but you get what I'm meaning. Some other languages. I don't like that. I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy delivering work that I can't read and do. I can't ensure the quality on myself. So, so where was I going with that? Yeah. So, I mean, trying things, sure. Being open to change during your career, sure. But not inherently necessary in life. There are some people who manage to not change in the wonderful ways you've described, you and Mila, for instance. I don't know, Jost, have you diversified a lot in your career or do you basically translate? I don't know, you know.
I have diversified quite a bit. So I if I would look at my the time that I spent and the income that I get to answer one of the questions that came up in the messaging app, I do about 30%, maybe 30 to 40% translation. And then 60%, I'm doing a lot of writing, as many of you know, my newsletter and all that. And I'm also working on another translation-related project, but not related to the, you know, not related. It's actually a religious kind of project, but that I'm, you know, paid for and that, you know, is really interesting. So, and to the question, by the way, in the message app was, do the activities and or does the diversification mean that you are paid about equally in your diversified areas compared to your core services in translation and interpreting? And I think that would very well be the case. And in fact, for me, I'm also doing consulting as a diversification. Consulting typically is paid more highly than translation. Right. So I think that could very well be and often is the case.
I usually stick around a 75-80% as translation, and the rest would be what people would be considered my diversification. So I'm fairly, so I have a core, if you like, that's still the foundation that I wouldn't like to do without. But everyone's different, right? They've got
many pies. To add to it from maybe a little different perspective. So yes, it obviously makes sense to diversify and have different things in our portfolio so that you have something to fall on, or you have, at least in terms of the LSP, you're in different areas and hopefully, like the way we looked at diversification, we want to be in the areas or in the verticals that have recessions at opposite times. And so that kind of helped with that. Because actually being in oil and gas in 2008 was wonderful. It was one of the best years, or some of the best years, whereas the rest of the world was going through a terrible recession. We didn't even notice. It was probably one of our best years. But at the same time, I want to look at it from a personal perspective. And from personal perspective, as an individual, you want to do what you love, because then you don't work a day in your life, right? And if you focus on doing what you love, you actually become really, really good at it. And one of the things I can, from personal experience, when we work with linguists who are really, really good at it, we suddenly cost becomes not such a big issue, because you want to go to a really, really top expert in a particular field. Mm-hmm. And so then you end up actually being compensated more for doing what you love, for what you're really good at. And I know some people, I know one gentleman, all he likes to do is research and teach. And that's the only two things that he does, and is incredibly successful. He doesn't even like to drive anymore. He doesn't, you know, he's kind of outsourced all of the other functions in his life, so he can just focus on what he does. He spends the time in the car reading or researching. So if we focus on doing what we love, we have a much more rewarding personal experience. And then we also can command a higher rate of compensation for that. And we have successes on both sides. There are some companies that are incredibly diversified. And I think on Amazon right now, you can buy just about everything, you know, and they're very diversified. But you also have examples of companies that just do one thing, but they do that one thing really well.
Yeah,
and then you go to them. So they're both options.
Mm-hmm. To me, it seems like you know, whether diversification is a necessary activity for a translated interpreter and or interpreter. So one thing that comes to my mind is that it seems that if you are highly specialized in something, take you as an example, Karen, with, you know, chemistry. I assume that part of your work and activity includes that you read up on new developments in chemistry, right? So that kind of diversification, mm-hmm. if you have a specialization that is very specific and where you have to be at the, you know, at the forefront of what's happening in that industry, I think that kind of diversification, if that indeed is a diversification or just part of the job description, and that might very well be the case.
Yeah, I wouldn't call professional development to build my subject matter expertise diversification. I would call that supporting my core skills, I suppose, because I have to do that in order to, you know, my PhD was a long time ago, right? So, you know, and obviously there's new technology all the time. And that's why the non-native editing is so great, because I'm reading new technologies all the time when I do that kind of work. So I'm not only am I learning, but I'm getting paid to learn. So that's even better, because I do what I love. You make a good point, Mila, about doing what you love. And I wouldn't love translating contracts or who knows what else. But I always refuse. I refuse a lot of translation work because I have a good reputation for doing what I do well. So people try me for things that might not be chemistry, right? I'm just like, the number of medical records I refuse in a year, shocking. But no, thank you. I'm not translating your medical records. Anyway, I digress. Where were we?
Development within your specialization.
Right. Yes, I don't think subject matter expertise is building that. I don't see that as a.
I think that's a really good point. But yeah. What I do tell young translators when they are starting in the field, that is really important to specialize. Clearly, we all agree with that. But I think especially after this year, what I would tell translators more than before would be say, you got to specialize maybe in two fields. You know, you got to specialize. Don't put all your, marbles into one basket, but have another one available to you. I think that's a lesson that some of us have learned, maybe a little painfully this year. That is a good. Business model to have, to not only be good in one thing, but maybe two or three things will be helpful also.
Karen is specializing in one field. She's specializing in chemistry, but she is doing multiple things within that one field.
So
that in a way, because then you're kind of having to pick two things, you know, in Karen's case, would it be chemistry and then what else, you know, literature. But Karen is specializing in one field, but then within every one field, there are very, very many things if you really look in depth.
Right. And that's a perfect example of how diversification doesn't have to be across different industries, like it is for, that's the obvious way to go for some people, but I've gone a different way and stayed now. Someone told me right at the beginning, you won't get enough work in chemistry. You need to do medical too. I was told that by someone who was reviewing my CV, and I didn't. I stuck with what I know, which is the industrial regulatory side of pharma and chemistry and the areas I worked in the industry in. But I recognize that I'm unusual in being that narrow and having managed to stay that narrow. So,
but wait, you do different work. The work we do with Corinne McKay, for example.
Training
that
other
is diversification.
That yes. is a diversification. Yes, you're right. We haven't mentioned
that's
that.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what Yoast, you right. know. Yes.
So
you are diversifying.
If I diversify in, so like many translators who have expertise in the field, I started giving sessions at translation conferences for translators and interpreters, or even occasionally for chemists and other people, but people started wanting to pay me to do more of that. But the training I do, it all fits. I train largely in my subject area, mm-hmm. or in scientific and technical writing. So when I'm training someone, I'm training, and I'm a believer that you learn when you teach. You know, when you write, you know, the idea of
that's
writing to learn or preparing
that's
to
true.
Teach. So I've built my own skills in doing all the research I do to teach anyone else about these things and to use them in my own practice. So you're right. I do earn some money each year from training technical translators in things, but I do as much voluntarily as I earn in that. You know, that's
no, that's fine. But it is a diversification. That's the point we're talking about. No, it is a diversification. So,
not many. Sorry, I'm conscious that if the interpreters must be frustrated if we.
I mean, that does bring up one question that when we met a few days ago, talked about whether we should talk about that. And that is sometimes the training of other translators or, writing books with business advice to other translators or, you know, offering services to help other translators sometimes is sort of looked down upon, I think, as kind of a soft skill, a soft specialization, or something that sort of inherently is being described as, well, if you do have all these business skills as a trendsetter or interpreter, why do you have to teach others? And why don't you make lots of money, you know, using those skills yourself, doing translation and interpreting? Any opinion on that?
It's a criticism I've heard. So that principle of selling to other translators rather than consulting to end clients, that kind of thing. I think it's fair to say that the peer-to-peer soft skills market for translators is well served, but that there are lots of people offering peer-to-peer services. And that does rub some people the wrong way, but that inspires others. There's a market for it, right? I don't like the idea of hierarchy is making a hierarchy out of these.
I'm so having a hard time with that word because I can't do it. It doesn't fit into my German brain.
It's better for me to teach someone chemistry than it is to help someone to design their website, right? I don't think there's a better or worse there.
But I want to expand this a little bit. So I was looking at some numbers, and 40% of the world don't have access to education in the language they understand. Okay, so that's UNESCO numbers from this year. And we have, how many languages do we have today? About 200 maximum that we can really find on the internet. So if you log into Google, if you try to log into Wikipedia, if you try to read something, let's say in Fulani, and Fulani language has 60 million speakers, how much content are you going to find in that language? So what happens to, and in Africa, one of us brought Africa at one point, Africa was not logged in. 60% of the people, of the children in Africa, don't have access to the internet. And then out of those kids who do, let's say they have the electronic device, they have electricity, they have a computer, maybe at the library, they log on. And more than 50% of these people have no access to education, or according to UNESCO, 40 in their language. What happens in the language that they speak? The true disparity today is by access to information. We have so much untapped work and field in reaching out to those other communities, mentoring communities. There are communities where people want to become a translator. They just don't know how. Like, Gio, like you fell into this in Brazil with Portuguese, but what if it's a language of lesser diffusion? What if it's Kiren or Kireni or Lisgan or some other language? So there is a huge market for training other translators. Mm-hmm. And it exists just, again, outside of our bubble. There's that whole other universe where people don't even know that it's a thing.
Right. In Brazil, we have significant Quilombola population. Those are the descendants of enslaved individuals who ran away. We also have all the Indian cultures. They have no representation online, and many of their communities do not have electricity or computers, access to internet, for example. Well, what do you do about them? Same situation. So I don't have to go that far from Brazil. How about the people in the Appalachian Mountains here in the U.S.? Those communities way up there.
And we have Native American communities right here in the U.S. We have about a lot of Mayan speakers, even here. Yeah. We see a lot of these languages in Texas. So as a community of language professionals and language companies, as a language industry, there is a lot of things we can do. You know, we can expand a lot. You know, again, we're three of us, I think, on board with Translation Commons. They're one of the groups that's working on the projects. But in terms of peer-to-peer training, I think there is a vast need for that that hasn't been served, that hasn't even been started or tapped into and open.
So this is really cool. I had kind of hoped to sneak in diversity at the end of our session. That just happened naturally. You brought it up. So, you know, diversification and diversity, obviously, they're very similar. So I thought, let's talk about diversity also. And I think that you are bringing up a super important point. are sort of seeing ourselves as people of the world. We parlay in foreign languages, etc., as translators and interpreters, but we forget that we are serving a very, very, very tiny fraction of the world as far as the percentage of languages that we are serving. And I think we do have an obligation as translators and interpreters to keep that in mind and choose appropriate action to bring in so many that are not being brought in otherwise, right? That are, that are being essentially left out. And I'm thankful for what you have done with Translation Commons and what Translation Commons is doing overall. We recently had the UNESCO Year for Indigenous Languages, and we're going to have a whole decade, I think, starting next year, which will bring a lot of opportunity to talk about things that are really important. But the translation and interpreting industry has to play a really important role there. It has to, I think. I mean, because we are the ones that have a more profound understanding of what language access means, even though we do think only about those 200 languages you're talking about. We just have to push ourselves to include a lot more than just those 200 languages. And even like you said earlier, Mila, including languages that do not have a written form, we have to communicate orally in some way or the other, right? And so I think that's a really, really important point. Diversity, of course, can also mean Black Lives Matter, is happening, more this year and more in a more forceful manner. I think the protests are being, displayed here in America, being done here in America as well as elsewhere. And we had a really interesting experiment not too long ago. Many of you listeners and watchers will know about the Translation Talk Twitter account, which is something you really need to follow if you don't follow that. It's fabulous. It's a rotation curation account, which means that every week somebody else gets to curate the account and does whatever with the account that he or she likes to do. And those people who curate are either translators or interpreters or are really, closely connected with our industry. And amazing things are being posted and being said. But a few weeks ago, Gio happened to be the curator for that week, and she invited a number 8, I think, or 7 or something like that, African American sign language interpreters, who brought up, among other things, the large gap in diversity in our industries. In the sign language community, there's actually less of a gap, I think, than in the translation and interpreting communities here in America, I know for sure, but assumably elsewhere also, that, the ethnic representation of, what it could be in our industries is not nearly as what it should be. And I wonder, Gio, whether you could talk about, I have to tell a joke that I have official permission from Karen to do it. I'm not going to ask Karen this because Karen is a true hashtag Karen. Only people here in the US will get that. So Karen is kind of a Karen is like the typical white person living in the suburbs, white woman living in the suburbs. But that's actually as far as the similarities between the hashtag Karen and tactic. She is not a real Karen. But anyway, I'm not going to ask her. I'm going to ask Gio whether you can talk a little
bit about
a program that Abratis has been doing. Like I mentioned before, you're the president of Abratis. This program was actually started long before your presidency. But when I learned about it, I was so impressed with it. And I'm not sure that it's completely replicable in other countries, just like that, but still it's something that I think gives us a really good idea how we can improve diversity, ethnic diversity within our professions. You want to talk about that, Gio?
Oh, definitely. You're giving me goosebumps, you know. I love the work Abraxas does. It's very different from the other associations I am involved with, because it does not focus on the professional from the professional point of view only, but as a whole. So as far as benefits are concerned, we offer health insurance, life insurance for the whole family, car rental discounts, hotel discounts, a bunch of different stuff. And for our members specifically, we have created the mentorship program. And the program that Yost is talking about, it's called Abraxas Afro. Have you ever heard of the neck test? No? It's when you look around the room, stretch your neck, and you do not see people like you around. And that is extremely common in my country. If you go to an ATA event, stretch your neck and check how many people of color, how many people of Asian descent, etc., are represented. Not that many. The reason why? I have no idea. The same thing happens in Brazil. But one of our members brought that up to one of our presidents, who said, you know what, we can fix that. And that's how the program was started, because one person spoke up. And we have, we got this association that is a neighborhood association together. And we're offering classes in the communities. The favelas, as you know here, know the shanty towns. So we are offering classes over there. And the students are not only poor individuals, uneducated individuals. No, some of them have doctorate degrees. Some of them have master's degrees. Some have BAs. Some are just high school students. And a complete different makeup from what was expected. And we are training them on how to become translators and interpreters. Now, this is not an isolated thing, it's not just an Abraxas thing. Other entities have joined forces with us, universities. There is one LSP, Aliança Translations, that came and told us, you know what, those people who graduate, we want those graduates. We want them. We're going to offer them a paid internship. And of the group, we're going to keep two in our staff. So now we are starting V2, version 2 of Abraxas Afro. And it is something that really moves me, really.
And it is fantastic that you're doing that. And what brought up to me is, again, I want to talk about bubbles, because there are certain bubbles that are existing that we want to learn more about, and we need to figure out a way how to. So, for example, Houston Community College started an interpreting program for that is not limited by language. It is not just French or just German. They figured out a way to teach for all languages. And they have different tracks. They have a localization track, healthcare, they have legal, and they have, again, a diversity of students in their program. It is incredibly multinational, because it's not one. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a tremendous amount of diversity, because one of our strengths and specialties is languages of limited diffusion. And that's where we get the next billion speakers. And there, it is a completely different demographic. There, I'm the only person in the room of this demographic. Everybody is completely different. But there is a complete lack of education. You're right. And among those people, we find people with degrees, people who are refugees but may have been a doctor in their country, people who may have completely different skills and just in a different circumstance at the moment. So it's a complete wealth of talent, amazing yes. people. And so, but again, they they are excluded, that they're in isolation from our main industry events, from main industry conferences, from main industry training. So I think one of the things we can do as a group is connect those dots, connect those bubbles, bring those people in.
Yeah, I just want to add something. While putting that program together, we learned something that it differs from America. In Brazil, most sign language interpreters are of African descent.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. You know, there is a great representation. We learned that while doing this program. And also, Abraches involves sign language interpreters in our group. We represent them too. Yesterday, we just signed an agreement for some specific programs with the National Federation of Brazilian Sign Language Interpreters and Guides. But we've always had sessions in our conferences that were presented in sign language with spoken language interpretation. You know, and we always have sign language interpreters during our plenary sessions. So Abraches is extremely, extremely open-minded, and I absolutely love it. And this is a great experience for me.
Yeah, and I want to do a little plug for Abraches also. I was privileged to speak at a conference a few years ago, especially if you speak Portuguese, many of the sessions are in Portuguese, of course, in Abraches. It's a very, very professional conference that you put on every year, and it's just it's a really great place to go to and to expand your horizon. So it's a wonderful organization that I admire greatly.
Thank you.
I wonder whether you, Karen, you.
I was going to say I peeked at the texts, the chat during that, and I wondered if I could address a couple of questions.
Oh, please do, please.
So Chris, I think, asked both of them. I'm not sure. Anyway, so to what extent is hourly income higher or lower than for, say, core translation work? So for me, the averages work out about the same. Except for training. The paid hours is paid well or better, but the prep, once you factor in the prep hours, I would say any training I do for other translators is usually not paid as well as everything else I do. So my gross or net, my hourly income for translation is high because I work fast and I'm, you know, even if I don't usually bill per word, I'm usually on flat rates because that's how I've evolved. But so that's the answer to that. And yes, absolutely. Feedback from anyone, I don't think that anyone is going to be a great translator or interpreter for long unless they're getting feedback from at least peers, but ideally from the best possible person. So if it's clients, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Well, is there anything? I also sort of peeked at the messaging. I think there is nothing, no burning question aside from very nice comments. Do any of you have like a closing statement for what you would like to take?
I don't know if it's a closing statement, but it's a question. And again, Gio, you are the instigator that brought it up. So we are not connected to sign language. There's 300 plus sign languages spoken in the world. And I don't know how many of us know that. And for some reason, sign language events happen, and there are all these different same issues. There are issues of localization. There are issues of getting information from language to language. And that's another way of how we as an industry, and that's a question, and maybe to you, Jost, or maybe to Gio, how can we as an industry integrate and connect and be actually inclusive of sign language and long tail language and true diversity among ourselves? Mm-hmm. How can we see that at LocWorld? How can we see that at ATA? What do you think?
Here in ATA, here in the US, the ATA is kind of was created completely separate from the sign language. Sign language is under ADA, and they see themselves also as a completely separate reality. That is my personal experience. I may be completely wrong, but that's the way I see it. Okay. Even when I was working with the medical interpreters, the area related to sign language was viewed in, was looked at in complete awe. They developed so strongly. You become an interpreter and then you differentiate into whatever field you want to work in. And you go from there. They have specific training, blah, 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 blah. Sign language in Brazil is our second language, officially declared in our constitution as a second language. It has not become a reality in our country yet. We have, we don't have sign language as a normal course taught at schools. It's become present now in universities, which creates a complete gap, because what most people do not know is the deaf community has its own culture. Their language is totally different from English. Some of them mean, or Portuguese or whatever spoken language in the country they're from. Their grammatical structure may have similarities, but the way they communicate is different. Their perception of things, and even some of them, at least in Brazil, they do not read Portuguese. They do not understand. You can put the subtitles in a movie. They don't know what's going on because they do not read it. Their world is in their hands and facial expressions and body language. So what we are doing with Abraches is reducing that gap by bringing the two communities together and see how we can march forward helping each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I do not understand, I do not see a way of that happening here unless it's brought from the cupola down. ATA and the American Sign Language Association coming together and creating that reality.
Right. And I think to me it seems that this is something that I think what we've seen just in the last couple of years with technology again is that all kinds of technology, you know, if you look at the headlines and papers about translation, you see every 6 weeks you see another pair of gloves that have been invented for sign language that, you know, automatically translate sign language into written language or something. And what typically you'll see if you see someone look at that, some of the comments or the responses by people who rely on sign language is like, we don't want that. We're not interested in that. So I think the sign language community in particular is a community that I think if there is a desire to, for instance, partner with translation and interpreting associations, that would be really great. But I think it's something that has to come from that community rather from us going out and saying, we want to partner with you. I mean, I think we should always be open to partnerships if indeed that is something that is desired on the part of that community. But I think that what you said, Gio, is quite true, that it's a very different community that has really different approaches in many ways, and approaches that we as hearing people or as non-sign people, you know, think are good for that community are not necessarily good for that community.
Exactly.
So I think that, you know, any kind of approach has to be very sensitive and very, very them focused rather than us focused. That's my sense. Any other? We only have a few minutes left. To me, you know, this was a tremendous panel. I learned a lot. I thought it was really super fun. Any thing that you would like to add?
Well, I'll say that we did not talk about professional longevity, and we need to do another one to discuss that, another panel.
Right. I'll talk to Taka and Renato and let them know that we'll need to do that.
I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot. And so thank you for everybody who attended. And thank you, Karen. Thank you, Gio. And thank you, Jos.
Yeah, well, thank you all also. And I once again want to thank MemSource for providing the sponsoring for this. I want to thank Multilingual setting this up and for giving us, by the way, I want to say that, giving us complete freedom to do with what with this hour and a half what we wanted to do. So it's not something that they said, let's do this. Instead, they said, here's the hour and a half, what do you want to do with it? And I'm very thankful for that. Thank you to Kudo for providing this platform. Thank you to the interpreters, of course, that I didn't listen, but I presumably did a really good interpreting service. Thank you very much. Sorry for speaking so fast. And Karen would like to apologize for speaking Scottish. It's not her fault. That's who she is, okay? anyway, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
I hope that,
that
the audience learned as much as the four of us did. And yeah, thank you. And by the way, I'm not sure when, but this whole event has been recorded and will be available on the very website where you went for the registration as a video. So you can either send it to friends if you think it was helpful or watch it again. So thank you very much all. Really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, everyone.
Hi.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.